Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Apple bias. Today is Sunday, October 1st, 2017, rabbit, and this is show number 647. Well, this is a mammoth episode. I've only got a couple of articles, but Bart decided, as part of Security Bits, to teach us all about cookies and why third-party cookies are a bad thing and how Apple is annoying some of the creepier ad networks by protecting us from them. Anyway, add to that a couple of security mediums, some notable breaches, some notable security updates, and suggested reading, and we have a fantastic set of content for you. Now, you know I'm a huge fan of everything Bart Bouchatz does, and one of my favorites is his podcast, Let's Talk Photography. Sometimes he's got a panel of enjoyable photographers, and sometimes it's him by himself. When he's on his own, he does it because he has something he wants to teach. They're terrific episodes where I always learn a lot. But this month's episode was mind-blowing in what I learned. I don't want to spoil it because, well, I couldn't possibly do it justice because he did a lot of work on this episode, but I'll say that he explains the term exposure and the term EV. Now, that sounds simple enough, but he takes us back to how the term was developed, what controls on your camera affect exposure, but then the real magic is when he explains how those controls are interlocked. Now, maybe you knew what he ends up teaching us here, but in all my years, I mean, my first SLR was back in 1978, and no one has ever explained this exact thing to me. Bart says at the end of the episode that while it's the shortest episode he's ever produced, it's the one that took him the longest to research and figure out how to explain. Anyway, I highly encourage, if you're into photography at all, to go check it out. You can find the episode at let's-talk.ie, and I've got a link in the show notes directly to this episode. Well, in a shocking turn of events, I actually followed everything Bart taught us in Programming by Stealth this week. Bart walked us through his solution to last week's HTML5 forms validation homework, and in so doing, highlighted some especially clever things that he did. I was pretty pleased with my own version of the homework, and in fact, Bart gave me a gold star for one of the things I did when I created my solution. Bart also explains how he used CSS to make his form even more readable. But in the second half of the episode, he shows us how to use jQuery to improve the forms even more. He demonstrates how certain requirements cannot be met with the built-in forms validation in today's web browsers, but how we can use jQuery to fix that problem. I love this episode because it tied in our knowledge of jQuery back to the HTML forms, and I actually understood everything. There were a lot of episodes I've been lost if you've been listening along. Anyway, I love this episode, so I hope you'll be inspired to join in the fun by subscribing to either the Programming by Stealth feed or Chit Chat Across the Pond, which has all of the episodes in your podcatcher of choice. Remember last week when we played Which Screen is Bigger, the iPhone 8 Plus or the 10, also known as Fun with Geometry? Well, I went through in rather excruciating detail how to calculate the size of the screen on the iPhone 10 versus the iPhone 8 Plus. I wrote it up first as a blog post, and Steve, also an engineer, checked all of my math before I posted it. The blog post was up for 2 days when many of you read it. But then on Sunday, I read it out loud as part of the No Silicast. And on Monday, Kazim and Jill both wrote to me telling me of an idiotic error I made. Remember when I calculated the area of the circles and I subtracted them from squares and such to take into account the roundy corners on the iPhone 10? Well, I said that the area of a circle is pi d. As Kazim so eloquently posted on the blog as a comment, my maths is rusty, but I thought the area of a circle is pi radius squared, not pi diameter, which is what you used here. Seriously, can you believe I did that? Can you believe Steve missed it in his careful checking? Can you believe none of you who read the blog post caught it either? One of the reasons I do the blog posts ahead of time is so you guys can catch the dumb things I say before it's in the podcast. I sound like an idiot. So yes, I'm throwing everyone under the bus with me on this one, except for Kazim and Jill, who are the only two who pointed it out. I bet there's a bunch of you who noticed it and didn't tell me, so it's even worse. Anyway, I was so appalled at myself that I punished myself. I went back to my drawing and I made the line thicknesses much thinner in my drawing. I remember I used a vector design tool called Affinity Designer, and I had kind of thick lines when I did it. So I made them much thinner so I could zoom in super tight and make sure I could get the circles exactly spot on the vector drawing from Apple. And that's when I discovered another mistake But this time in Victor H's explanation, the one he did over on iPhoneArena.com. He used a drawing from someone else to do his calculations. However, the radius shown for the big round corners is way off. It doesn't matter for Victor's calculations, though, because I'm still convinced he used wildly wrong pixel dimensions for the iPhone 8 Plus screen, so he's way off anyway. Now here's the funny thing. My calculations didn't change all that much when I used the correct equations for the circular area. But I've redone the blog post admitting there that I messed up too, and the iPhone 8 Plus 8 still has a bigger screen area in square inches than the iPhone 10, so George is still right, but it's much closer than it was. Turns out the iPhone 8 Plus is less than 1% bigger than the iPhone 10. Well, like I said, I'm embarrassed beyond belief, and that's why I actually waited 2 days after they told me about the mistake before I fixed it, and I sure hope there's no more mistakes in there. If there are, I really hope you guys tell me sooner next time. I know High Sierra has come out already, but after a week with iOS 11 and watchOS 4, I really want to talk about what has surprised and delighted me about these two operating systems. Turns out, in this case, there's no big, long, involved story here, just kind of a rambling list of what has made me smile in the past couple of weeks. First of all, both watchOS and iOS seem to have been improved visually, for me at least. Take the watch, for example. The keypad to type in your PIN was okay, but it was pretty easy to mistype. In watchOS 4, they made it way bigger, and now it's a lot harder to make mistakes. I still manage to mess it up from time to time, but I think that's on me now, because it's about as big as they could make it. On iOS 11, on the iPhone, there's a lot of big, bold headings. Like in Mail, the letters are huge, telling you that you're in all inboxes. No mistaking that, and I kind of like it. Now, this is a silly thing, but the fact that in iOS 11, the contacts logo is now a male and a female kind of makes me happy. Oh, and I squealed with delight when I realized the Maps logo is now Spaceship Park off of the 280. You know, every time I see Spaceship Park as the name, it does seem, is it Spaceship Park? Oh, well, anyway, it's not really called that. But anyway, it seems to me like they really should call it Two Infinite Loop now, doesn't it? Well, let's see. WatchOS 4 has a bunch of little improvements that do make me smile. On activity, you get 3 rings, red for active calories, green for minutes of exercise, and blue for standing once an hour over 12 hours. Now with the new OS, every once in a while, when you meet one of your goals, you get a red, green, and blue ring of fire. It's really cool. Now, I haven't found a pattern yet to when it decides to reward you, because I finish my circles almost all the time, and I don't get that all the time, but when it happens, it's like, woo, look, it's like this ring of fire. It's really cool. When it does, it's really exciting. Probably my single favorite thing in watchOS is that it's way easier to switch between apps. Now, here's my scenario. I start up Pocket Cast on my iPhone to play a podcast. Then I tell Siri on my watch to start an open outdoor walk. While I'm exercising, the watch face will show me the status of my walk, with stats like my pace and my heart rate and how far I've walked. But then, let's say I get into an area where somebody's running a weed whacker and I want to turn up the volume. On watchOS 3 and before, these are the steps to accomplish that, to turn up the volume. First, hit the side button, which reveals a set of apps that you've painstakingly predefined using the watch app on the iPhone to be in, I think they call it a dock, but it doesn't feel like a dock. Well, no matter how you configure this list of apps, the app you want is not the first one available ever, ever, ever. So that means swiping to get to it. In my case, I want the audio controls. Once I've swiped to it, I have to tap it. Then and only then can I turn the digital crown to raise the volume. But to be honest, it's worse than that. Even though I use this feature several times a day, I would almost always instinctively swipe first on the screen, which would only take me to the pause end controls for the workout. Frustrated, I would then instinctively hit the digital crown. That would take me to the home screen. Okay, what? I'm supposed to be hitting the side button. So finally, I'd hit the side button, proceed as I should have done in the first place. It was a lot of steps. But in watchOS 4, when you look at the workout on the watch face, there are 2 dots below it, indicating that if you swipe over from right to left, there's something else to see. And guess what that something else is? It's the audio controls for my podcast. Now, I'm not sure how it works with other apps. It might work with a second app like Maps. I don't really know. By the way, I do want to thank Steve for finding this one because it makes me happy every single day. Now, at this point, some of you are yelling into your devices, but Allison, you wear AirPods. Why don't you use Siri to raise and lower the volume? Well, we don't know. That's a big joke, but I'll answer it anyway. To use Siri on the AirPods, you double tap, you wait for the Siri tone in your ears, you tell her what you want, and then you wait an even longer time for her to execute the instructions. That's if she decides to listen to you at all. Now I walk and run down on the beach, and there's a lot of spots along the way where, I don't know, she just goes off and gets a margarita or something and pays no attention to me at all. She'll come back and go, no, I don't really feel like doing that right now. Check later. It's almost exactly those words. All right, but let's talk about something good about AirPods with the new OSs. Not sure where AirPods get their instruction, from watchOS or iOS, but something new arrived when both OSs showed up. With the older headphone firmware, you had to choose what a double tap against the headphones meant. You could choose either play pause, or you could choose to have Siri controls. And even though she's often recalcitrant, as I mentioned, I went with Siri. When I went for my first walk after upgrading both OSs, I double tapped my right AirPod, expecting to chat with Siri. And instead, my audio paused. Well, I was seriously annoyed because that is not how I had set it. I went into settings on my iPhone to figure out how to put it back the way I wanted it. I have to tell you, it's quite an adventure trying to find this control. The main trick is you have to have your AirPods connected or the case open for the menu to actually be available in settings. It took me a long time to find it because when I was trying to find it, my AirPods were closed, so the menu just isn't even there. That's real helpful. Anyway, once you turn them on, you know, open the case or stick them in your ears, you go to Settings, Bluetooth, and you tap on the I to the right of the name of the AirPods. When I finally figured this out, I was again delighted to find a whole amazing new feature. Turns out, now you can have one option on the left for double tap and a different option on the right AirPod. I am so excited by this. I chose play pause for the left and Siri on the right. They also have, you can have next track and skip track as options, which I don't know, that's a music thing you might want to pick. Well, after my AirPods stopped obeying my double tap correctly, it got me thinking. Maybe it was an active decision by Apple to change the behavior just so I'd go poking around in settings and discover the new capability. If they did it on purpose, that's actually kind of brilliant. It reminded me of me when my hot water pump and my water heater didn't give me hot water at the right time. I pulled up the Wemo app for my smart outlet that controls the timing for the hot water pump and discovered that the Wemo needed a firmware update. I thought that was a brilliant way to alert me because I'd have never noticed like an indicator light on the device, especially since mine is inside the water heater closet. Okay, here's another fun one. I wanted to know my heart rate. So rather than fiddling with the watch, tapping to the home screen, and then finding the heart rate app, I just raised my wrist and said, "Hey Siri, what's my heart rate?" What I saw surprised me. The screen that came up offered a feature that I remember they mentioned on stage, but I had not found out how to enable. Here's what it said. Heart rate can notify you when Apple Watch detects a heart rate that rises above 120 beats per minute while you appear to have been inactive for 10 minutes. You can adjust or turn off these notifications in the Apple Watch app on your iPhone. Well, one of the reasons I exercise so much is because my father had his first heart attack at age 43. Please note that I said first heart attack at 43. Well, that is always in the back of my mind. And along with that is the fact that heart disease is the leading killer of women. So yes, please, I would really love to know if my heart rate starts going up for no reason. After I agreed to be notified, the watch also told me my heart rate. Now, speaking of heart rate, I've been enjoying the new feature that allows you to see a graph of your heart rate during a workout and your recovery rate. I still don't know how to evaluate whether this is good or not, and I mentioned that earlier. I asked a trainer friend of mine from the gym to look at my recovery rate, and she said, "That's great." I asked her to explain why it was great, and she said, "Because it goes down over time." I was hoping for a wee bit more understanding than that. Of course it went down. I stopped working out. In my case, it had gone from an average of 134 down to 75 beats per minute in about 2.5 minutes. Would it be better if it went down faster? Would it still be good if it went down to, say, 85 after 2.5 minutes? I need to do some more research and find out what we want it to look like. One thing to know, the green LEDs that are normally on during a workout will stay on after your workout. That makes sense. It's going to monitor your heart rate for 3 minutes for its recovery, so those lights have to stay on. But another thing I want to do, I really want to study up on, is the effect of starting another workout immediately. So Steve and I walk and run down on the beach, and we walk a third of a mile from where we park to where we start our real exercise. Now, round trip, I'm not going to walk two-thirds of a mile and not take credit for it, so I actually do three workouts back-to-back on my watch. A slow walk down to the beach, my speed walk or run on the strand, and then a slow walk back uphill. So last week, I ran for the first time in a couple of years. I've had this stupid foot injury that has sidelined running for me for a while. I looked at my workout while I was running, and I saw split times and pace and heart rate and all that kind of stuff. I stopped the workout when I hit the end. I immediately started a walking workout right after that. When I got home, the running workout was gone. Now, if you don't have an Apple Watch or a Fitbit or anything, you might not understand this, but credit is what it's all about. I know that I really burned the calories, but you want to see it in the app. You want the credit. Oddly, the active calories on my watch and back in the activity app, or in the workout app, wait, no, activity app, I always get confused. Anyway, the active calories did reflect the fact that I had gone on the run, which was good, but I have no record of my first run in like 2 years. The only thing I can think of is that the workouts now want to measure that recovery heart rate for 3 minutes, and if you interrupt it by starting another workout immediately, you lose the earlier workout. I need to do a controlled experiment to see if that's what happened. All right, I promised to get iOS 11 in a few minutes, but there's a few more things I like about watchOS 4. If you like to take a breather during your run, it's annoying to have to swipe over and hit pause and then hit resume before you start running. Now in the Watch app on your iPhone, if you open up the Apple Watch app, tap the My Watch tab, then tap on Workout, there's an option for Running Auto Pause. I tested it out, and sure enough, it pauses if you pause. Now, I'd like it to pause on other workouts too, but maybe the difference in activity isn't enough for the watch to register those changes. You can also set this up on the watch itself. Tap on Settings, Workout, and you'll see an auto pause toggle for indoor and outdoor runs. One of the most annoying things about the Apple Watch is the app screen. It's just this crazy glob of tiny little circle icons of apps. For the life of me, I've never once correctly tapped on the stopwatch app versus the timer, and I always seem to fat finger and tap on apps I'm not trying to select. With WatchOS 4, there's an option to have them be an alphabetical list, and I love this mode. I figured out how to set it, but it took me a long time to find it again to write it up for this article. That's because it's not in any of the stinking menus. You can change to alphabetical by doing a 3D touch on the watch screen when you're looking at that annoying app layout view. All right, enough watch talk. Let's get into what delights me about iOS 11. Now, I'm not exactly sure how they used to display it, but now when you make a phone call and your AirPods are awake, a little menu slides up from the bottom of the phone screen showing a cute little icon of the AirPods, the phone, or the speaker. That made me happy. It delighted me. Now, here's a problem to be solved and how Apple solved it for me. I use my phone in the car to play podcasts to the car stereo over Bluetooth, and that works pretty well. But sometimes I'm navigating on a long drive and my battery will drain quickly, you know, with navigation running, so I like to plug in a lightning cable to power. But as soon as I do that, it would always disable Bluetooth and I'd have to switch over to the iPod option of my car stereo input, you know, like an animal. Well, there's a lot of reasons that's annoying, but now in iOS 11, when I plug in the lightning cable on my iPhone, I get a screen that pops up, which has another cute little window asking if I want to use Bluetooth or the dock connector for audio. Now, it's curious that they use the old dock connector terminology, but it lets me keep on Bluetooth and I can still charge my phone, and that makes me happy. I take a lot of screenshots on my phone, especially to use on podfeed.com. That means my phone is jam-packed with images I don't necessarily want to save. With iOS 11, when you take a screenshot, you get a little floating window in the bottom left. If you tap on it, you can immediately make annotations on it and send it off somewhere using the share sheet. When you click done, it gives you the option to save if you want to, or delete immediately, and I love that option. If you want to deal with a screenshot later and let it save to your camera roll now, you can just flick that little floating window to the left, and it's gone from view. I'm not sure how often most people will use it, but I am thrilled to have built-in screen recording on iOS 11. You might have noticed that I like to teach, and while screenshots are usually the easiest way to show something, sometimes you really need a video. It's a little tricky to figure out how to do this. The new control center, which is fine on iPhone but annoys me on the iPad, is brought up with a swipe from the bottom. That is, unless you get an iPhone 10, when it will be come from the top right, which is also really annoying that they have it in two different places. Anyway, screen recording is found inside Control Center, but it won't be there when you go look for it. The good news is you can add and delete controls from Control Center. So open Settings on your iOS device, then go to Control Center, and then Customize Controls. There are now 18 different controls you can put in Control Center. Maybe just to annoy myself, I'll put them all in there. Maybe not. Anyway, one of the controls is called Screen Recording. Tap the green plus button when you're in this customized controls thing, and it will move to the include category up above. Then you can use the hamburger menus on the right to rearrange the controls. When you tap on the screen recording control, it will give you a 3-2-1 countdown, and then it will record until you swipe up and tap on the same control again to tell it to stop. It automatically drops the video into your photos library. From there, you can open the video, tap edit, and drag the ends of the timeline, say just to the left a smidge, that's that bright yellow line, which will trim off the part where you turned off screen recording. But you'll notice when you play it back that there's no audio on that recording. That's because you have to manually engage the microphone. Go back into Control Center and then 3D touch on the screen recording control first, and you'll see an icon showing that the mic is off. Tap once to turn it on, and on that same screen, you'll be able to start recording and you'll get audio and video. Super handy. There's one setting in iOS 11 that might be delightful, but at first it's highly confusing. You know how on iOS 10 you could swipe up from the bottom to get to Control Center and tap on Wi-Fi or Bluetooth the signals there and just shut them off? It was a great enhancement to the operating system. But in iOS 11, you can still swipe up from the bottom to get to Control Center. You can still tap on Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, and the symbol changes, but it does not turn them off. Instead, tapping on those buttons simply disconnects your device from whichever thing you were tapping on. So like I said, really confusing that they changed the behavior, and most people won't realize that it has changed. However, I've gone from anger about this into acceptance, and now I think I can see why they did it. I embedded an XKCD cartoon into the show notes that perfectly illustrates it. Here's the thing. How many times lately have you been on someone else's Wi-Fi and it's so bad that in frustration, you turn off Wi-Fi and drop back to cellular to get things done? And then later, you realize you forgot to turn Wi-Fi back on. You're sitting around home and you're wasting your cellular data. Well, this toggle in iOS 11's Control Center solves that problem. Swipe up. Tap, swipe down, and you're disconnected from that dodgy Wi-Fi, but when you get to the next Wi-Fi hotspot, you can still connect. I've decided to let this delight me. If you really want to fully turn off Bluetooth and or Wi-Fi, you can still do that in Settings or use the Airplane Mode button that's in Control Center. Let's see, iOS 11 also has a new Siri voice, which is more human-like. She's a tad too cheery for my taste, and it makes it a bit harder to call her a moron when she can't find the answer to your question. I figured out a task for which she's really useful, though. Try this. Say, "Hey Siri, launch Google Assistant." You'll often get the right answer. Now, Siri does have one other enhancement that I noticed. After you dictate your question to her, you can actually edit the text on screen that she transcribes. Now, while this is pretty cool in case she makes a mistake in transcription, in my experience, the problem isn't with transcription all that often. She usually gets the transcription right. She knows exactly what I said, but she doesn't know the answer to the question or refuses to tell me. There's a new feature in iOS 11 called Do Not Disturb While Driving. The idea is that if you get a text message of some sort while you're driving, it will auto-reply for you, telling the person messaging you that you're driving, that you won't see their message till you stop. It also tells them that if they reply with urgent, their message will go through to you immediately. You can enable this feature by going to Settings, Do Not Disturb While Driving. And there you'll find three options. You can go with automatically, when connected to Bluetooth, or manually. This sounded like a swell idea to me, so I went off on a drive with Do Not Disturb While Driving enabled. But things didn't turn out quite as I'd expected. This one little feature caused me to do an unintended tweet storm. Now, here are the steps I followed in case you want to do it too. Step one, I don't ever want to miss any of Steve's tweets. So a long time ago, I went to twitter.com/SB Sheridan, clicked on follow. You should all follow him. He's amazing on Twitter. But then I tapped on the three dots to the right of the follow button. You can only do this through the website, I think. From there, you have an option to turn on mobile notifications, which I did. Next, I went for a drive and I turned on Do Not Disturb while driving. Step 3. While I was driving, Steve sent out a tweet. So step 4 is Twitter sent a text message to my iPhone telling me about Steve's brilliant tweet, because they're all amazing. Step 5. My iPhone dutifully replied to this mobile notification, explaining that I was driving. Now here's the step I never would have predicted. A reply to one of these auto-generated mobile notifications actually goes out as a tweet. But of course, the response that Apple has created for us is way too long for a single tweet, so it broke it up into 4 separate tweets, even though none of them was anywhere near 140 characters, but it still did 4 separate tweets. The best part of this is I was completely unaware that any of this had happened. I got some sideways responses from my Twitter followers, but I didn't know what they were responding to. Why was this bothering? What had I done? After I figured it out and explained on Twitter, my favorite response was from Marina Eppelman, who said, "I thought it was the weirdest demo in history." So anyway, be careful of that. Well, you'll notice that I haven't been gushing over iOS 11 on iPad like many other podcasters have. I've heard them explaining how much more productive they are with drag and drop and how much better split screen and slide over are for them. I'm not sure yet how I feel about it. I do love having a dock, no doubt about that, but I'm not sure I like the slide over split screen dance just yet. I spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to get it to settle down and how to get it to go away. I know I swipe up for Control Center and I swipe farther if I want the app switcher. So far, so good. The app switcher is much easier than a double click of the home button, and I wish they had done that on the iPhone, but they didn't. But then trying to drag an app up from the bottom of the screen gets confused with Control Center. If I successfully get it to hover up there in that slide over mode, I can never tell whether I'm being inept because I can't get it to stick as split screen or whether the app combo I'm using doesn't support split screen. So you don't know which way you're going. All right, let's say I've got it in split screen. For the life of me, I've not found the pattern to get it out of split screen. I have successfully done it on occasion, but never twice in a row. Here's another confusion. If I stick Telegram to Mail, for example, so I've got Telegram on the right, Mail on the left, and it's in split screen, and later I just want to look at Telegram, I can't because it brings Mail along with it. I really liked the slide over, then scroll through your open apps method in iOS 10. It confused my little brain. Now, I also know I'm supposed to be positively swooning over the new Files app, but I haven't once needed to use it yet. I'm sure it's lovely, but the need just hasn't come up yet. I'm sure there's some problem I should be solving with it, but we'll see. Maybe I'll love it when I find a problem to be solved. And finally, I'm not fond of the look of the new on-screen keyboard on the 9.7 and 10.5-inch iPads. I don't hate it as much as Dr. Gary, who said, and I quote, "I hate it with the fire of 1,000 angry suns." But I think the little gray letters sitting above the real characters on the keyboard are distracting and ugly. Now, one of my big pet peeves, and if somebody knows somebody at Facebook who will help me get a fix to this, I'd really be happy about it. Facebook, on their app, has not yet recognized that there is a 12.9-inch iPad Pro. That means when I go into Facebook, I've got this ridiculously big keyboard. It's not the real keyboard. So I see the 9.7-inch on-screen keyboard on a 12.9-inch iPad Pro. So it takes up pretty close to half of the screen, and it's got those ugly little gray letters sitting above it. So I would love to find somebody at Facebook who could say, could you just do that little API thing? Could you just look for it? It's been like, what, a year and a half, 2 years since the 12.9-inch iPad Pro is out? They could do it if they wanted to. Anyway, back to the ugly little gray letters sitting above the real characters. It also confused me that those spare characters are above the real ones, and yet you swipe down to get to them. Why don't you swipe up to get them? Well, finally, at one point, I did it really slowly, and I realized that the idea is it's like you're pulling the key down to reveal what's above it. It works, but I still think it's ugly. And like I said, luckily for me, the 12.9-inch iPad Pro has a full-size keyboard with all of the keys labeled, like nature intended, unless you're using the Facebook app. Well, overall, I'm surprised and delighted by almost all of the changes, which makes these some great updates in my book. Well, Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Security Bits with Bart Bouchatz. What are we looking at this week, Bart? Is it going to be fun, horrific, short, long? What do we got?
Well, it's not short and long, but other than that, it's pretty much all of those things. There's a lot. We have three security mediums, if that's any sort of metric for how you measure these things.
I find those the most interesting, though, even when they're horrific. Yeah.
Well, I mean, that is why I pulled them out to be mediums, right? It's, you take the stories that take a little bit more thinking about than just here's a bullet point. Now let's move on.
Yeah, get some chewing done on it.
Exactly. Before we get stuck into new stuff, I just wanted to sort of say that last time we talked about Equifax and we talked about Face ID, technically the Face ID was in a separate segment, but it was me and you talking, so I consider it a follow-up. And there's been a few more news stories since, so I've sort of collected those together at the top of the show notes. They're more suggested reading, really, than anything we need to deep dive into, but I figure we should let people know that there have been some developments. In the Equifax one, there's a few things worth quickly mentioning. So the Equifax have a new CEO. I don't know how that happened. The other guy basically resigned and took a massive big pension and sod it off, which is fine. He's gone.
Tens or hundreds of millions of dollars or something for stealing our money.
18 million is what I read. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the new CEO was doing the whole media thing, and he announced that coming at the end of January next year will be a new service to replace the current credit freeze process. So the current credit freeze process means you have to pay a fee to have your credit stopped, and then you can't apply for any credit until you unfreeze it, which you have to pay a fee for, and then you refreeze it. It's a whole big bag of hurt. So they're offering a new service, which they're calling, I forgot to write down what they're calling it, but basically the credit lock. And this will be something which you will have for life, that you can freeze and that you can lock and unlock for free at any time you like.
But is it only as with respect to Equifax's product?
Yes. Yes. Now, something else I guess we should say, I don't have it as a link in the show notes as such, but we talked last time about, we had a bit of a disagreement about whether or not you needed to do a credit freeze at every agency.
Yeah.
And we were both right, but only both half right.
I'm happy I got half credit. When I looked at it, I thought I was totally wrong. So, okay.
So there are two things you can do. You can do a fraud alert and you can do a credit freeze. If you do a fraud alert, you do an alert for any one and they all obey it. If you do a freeze, it's only the one you do the freeze with.
Okay. So, which I think technically is what you did say.
Well, I didn't realize the difference between the alert and the freeze. So I, like I said, we were both right. We just both had parts of the big picture. So the advice on the Twit network has shifted from Leo was like, do a credit freeze. But Father something or other, who's stepped in since, is like, no, you're much better off doing a fraud alert, because you can do that for free generally, and you only have to do it in one place and they all have to respect it. So that's this fine points there that we didn't quite catch last time.
Yeah, I've seen so many debates on which one is the right one to do. I know sometimes buying an iPhone, depending on what's happening with the loan and not loan and stuff on buying a phone,
yeah,
that's going to require you to have your credit open. So we've chosen not to lock ours for the moment. Please don't hack me. But
Well, yeah, if you think about it, if you're buying a subsidized phone, that is a loan.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh, yeah.
You don't
absolutely
think of it as a loan, but it is a loan. So yeah.
I've seen.
I mean,
them
they're giving
ask
you an
me,
$800 device. So.
Yeah, I had a case where I bought a MiFi from Verizon where I was not doing a loan, and they insisted that they have my credit check. They wanted my Social Security number.
Unless they were afraid you'd run up a huge bill and then
it might have
off.
Been because it was a 2-year contract. I could be lying. Don't listen to me. Anyway.
Anywho, yes.
Yay.
Equifax also managed to blunder about basically accidentally linking out to a site that wasn't theirs because a typo squatter got there first. Now, luckily, that typo squatter was a security researcher making the point that what you are supposed to do is make subdomains on a domain you own so that you actually right. have some trust. What Equifax were doing was just registering random domain names and typing them wrong on their own website so other people could easily squat on them. I mean, how dumb do you have to be as a corporation? No matter how dumb I think Equifax are, they continue to surprise me.
Yeah, so I'm podfeed.com/funwithflags. Not what would the equivalent of what they did be?
Registering podfeedfunflags.com. A whole separate .com.
Great.
It's so stupid. Like, it's absolutely completely, you'd need to be an idiot to do that kind of a thing. Like, yeah. It's just ridiculous. But there we go. And there's some more additional reading from Brian Krebs, who's deep in this story. He was one of the people who sort of helped break it. So there's three more links there to more in-depth stories from Brian Krebs on the whole topic. And then in terms of Face ID, Apple released a white paper explaining how it all hangs together.
Oh,
so
that's
I have
good.
Links in. Exactly. So I have links in the white paper. No, I have links in the show notes to the white paper and also to a whole bunch of. Well, not a whole bunch, to four news stories which digest it for you. So if you'd like to read the whole thing yourself, well, you can do that. Or if you'd just like to read the summaries from other people, you can do that. Take your pick.
And they're the real ones, Mac Observer, The Verge, iMore, and Naked Security. Good.
Exactly. So they're people I trust. That brings us to our first security medium. Now, this one affects our Windows brethren. It doesn't affect us Mac users because this is an issue in a product that doesn't exist on the Mac. There is a free and very popular Windows security-ish, well, I'm not sure if it counts, well, I suppose it is sort of security. Anyway, it's a really popular freeware app on Windows called CCleaner. And it has turned out, or we have now been told by the people who own it, that their servers were hacked and a version of the download, now it's only the 32-bit version, not the 64-bit version, but a version of their installer was compromised. There was malware injected into it, and then over 2 million people downloaded this booby-trapped version of the installer.
Is this similar to what happened to Handbrake a while ago?
Exactly like that, yes. Exactly the same idea.
So yeah. Is
I mean, it's
CCleaner
different malware, but...
unsigned, or does unsigned exist in the Windows world?
Windows don't have gatekeepers, so they haven't quite reached us yet in that level. I think they're heading that way by having stuff be Windows Store only, but I don't think they've arrived at the point where the OS will
sign developers or anything. Okay,
you can do signing, but it's not the same.
Okay.
Windows 10 doesn't behave in the same way as the Mac in this way. So the signing thing isn't really the issue. It's not a thing over on the Windows side like
okay.
It is for us.
Okay.
Interesting in a bad way, I suppose. So this malware has been downloaded 2 million times, but it wasn't sort of doing malicious stuff everywhere. What it was doing, it was clearly very high. The attackers had targets in mind, and they figured the only way to get by, so big companies like Cisco and those kind of corporations were their target. And their attempt to get in was basically to just be on something really popular. When the malware ran, so when you ran the booby-trapped installer, it would phone home and that would tell the headquarters what the IP address was of the infected machine. And then the server would either reply with, shh, be quiet, don't do anything, don't draw attention to yourself, or excellent, go hack away.
Oh.
And so of those 2 million, most of them were dormant because they were only looking for about 20 corporations.
Hmm.
So based on how well put together the malware is, how well engineered the malware is, the security researchers who've been looking at it have come to the conclusion it's probably from a state actor, not in this case the United States, but a state with hostile intentions towards United States companies.
Mm-hmm.
So it's quite a sophisticated attack, actually, and it's a very clever technique to find a really popular free download, infect it, and then only make use of the possible access in the places where you wanted to get to. It's evil genius. All the wrong kinds of genius.
Yeah.
Links and show notes to various news stories from various sources, including the official announcement from the company who owns CCleaner. Hopefully none of our listeners are affected. If you are, I would start with the official announcement and follow all the advice they give you.
Okay. So, I mean, from what I remember hearing about this, the developers of CCleaner did the right things as far as announcing it and addressing
it. Yes, exactly.
It's sort of like, this happens.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, when it happens, you don't want it to be the case that companies are so scared of getting shouted at that they won't tell you. So this is the right way to have it. You know, it happens, you come out, you talk about it, you're open about it, and people give you credit for that. So, yeah, no, and I don't think they did anything particularly wrong. If this is a state actor, well, you know, resources. It's all about resources.
Yeah.
Security Medium the second is very much nothing to do with our Windows brethren and very much all on us Mac people.
Okay.
So security researcher Patrick Wardle has discovered a zero-day exploit in macOS, which allows any app, signed or unsigned, assuming, of course, you allow unsigned apps to run. If the app doesn't run, it can't infect you. But any app that you run, and it has to you have to actually execute the app. But if you run an app that has been booby-trapped in this way, it will steal, or it can steal, the content of your keychain, assuming your keychain is unlocked, which it will be when you're logged in. So basically what this boils down to is if you download some random app from the web and you allow it to run, it could steal everything in your keychain at the moment.
So I do like the way you describe this. All of the headlines were zero-day exploit in High Sierra. Well, it was actually in Sierra. And yeah. I don't know how far back, but it is a zero-day exploit. Now, I heard that the security researcher had talked to Apple and they didn't do anything about it before High Sierra. And that's why people are going like, see, they could have fixed it before High Sierra.
No, the date I saw was that he reported on the 7th of September and now he's gone public with it. And September is only just finished. That's not even Google give you 90 days and they're constantly getting in trouble for being too quick. Like it takes time and effort to engineer a solution, test the solution, make sure it doesn't break everything, make sure it actually is a fix. Like software engineering takes time. So I don't think that if you report something to Apple on the 7th of September and it's not fixed by the 30th of September that you're in any way justified to go public. I don't agree.
Yeah.
But anyway, public it is. So that's that. So it's called Keychain Stealer, by the way.
So does this mean we shouldn't use Keychain? You know, I love to say that.
I know you love to say that. No, what it means is that our usual advice of what it means is that when you run an untrusted app, you're implicitly trusting it. When you run an app, you're implicitly trusting it not to steal your stuff. That's always true. Now it's a little bit more true because usually it can only steal all of your files and now it can steal all of your files and your keychain. So all of our standard advice of don't run random stuff on the web is now twice as true.
Okay.
That's all it means.
Okay.
Because at the end of the day, you have to run this. You have to decide to trust an app and run it for that app to be able to do anything. So there's, unless you run something, this doesn't hit you. This can't hit you unless you run something malicious.
Good.
So it's not remote, which is good, right? Yeah. Okay, it's not good that it exists, but it's not Sky is Falling.
Good.
So that brings us on to...
We need to have some little font awesome icons here for which ones of these have like a big, you know, somebody with their hair on fire and somebody just with a small fire extinguisher.
And I wonder if there's an emoji for like weather we could use or something.
Yeah.
Like a thunder strike for the stuff that's a disaster. And I have a think about that. Could have some fun playing around. Security Medium the third then is a fun one. So nothing is wrong here. I just thought it might be nice to explain what Apple have done to make the advertisement industry's head explode.
Yeah.
So whether or not you upgraded to High Sierra, you will, assuming you're running a supported version of the Mac, you will have gotten a new version of Safari coming out to you.
Or at least been offered it.
Exactly.
Version 11, I think it is, on Sierra.
I think it's called version... Yes, version 11 is indeed the number. And that brings with it, I mean, the most user-facing feature it brings with it is the killing autoplay videos on websites, which everyone loves.
Yay!
But actually, the biggest thing it brings along is entirely under the hood, and it's basically Apple have added some intelligence to how they deal with cookies, and in doing so, have bumped up your privacy massively. It's not a panacea, but it is such a step forward. So in order to understand Apple's cleverness, we must first understand how the world worked before the cleverness.
Okay.
So how did things work? What was the problems? And then what did Apple change? So we're going to go back in our little time machine. You might go to the very, very early web. And initially, the web was a read-only medium. So HTTP as a protocol, so that's what is used to communicate with web servers. Your browser talks HTTP to a web server. It's a request response protocol. The idea was that you would say to a web server, "Dear web server, I want this URL." The web server would answer with that URL, and that was that. And if you then later asked that same web server something else, it was considered an entirely separate thing. There was no concept of state in the first versions of HTTP. So every interaction was a little island universe unto itself, because the web was just a way of publishing information. The concept of logging in, of having a shopping basket, none of that existed on the early web. But of course, all of that requires statefulness. If you add something to your basket and then browse to another page, the web server needs to know the next time you come back, it should show you your basket.
Right? Oh, it needs to have, that makes sense.
It needs to have a memory of the fact that it's the same conversation, which it didn't have. If there's no state, you have no concept of anything that ever went before.
Okay.
You can't log in. You can't have a basket. You can't do anything that involves remembering you from the last time you clicked on a link or the last time the page loaded for any reason. So to retrofit some sort of memory, the cookie was invented. So the cookie came later to add in this ability to remember people. And the way it works is that when you come to when your browser arrives at a web server, it looks inside it to see, do I have a cookie I was given earlier? And if it does, it hands the cookie back to the web server. But let's assume that you're visiting a site for the first time, so there is no cookie to hand back. So the web server gets a request saying, "Hello, I'd like the front page of Amazon.com. The Amazon.com server says, "Oh, that request had no cookie in it. Okay, this is a new person. We're starting a new conversation here." It will then make up some sort of random identifier to identify you. It's going to be, assuming it's a halfway decent website, a cryptographically secure, massive big random blob of probably hex. And you sometimes see these popped onto the end of URLs. If you go view your cookies in your browser, you'll see them all over the place. They're just random blobs of garbage. But that random blob of garbage is going to represent you for the remainder of your contact with that website.
You and what you've done there, like the fact that you've got something in your
it's a token. It's a token. So that token will then be used in the database on Amazon's web server to tag everything. So they will have a database with 1,000 web carts, and every web cart will have a different random token. So this web cart belongs to that random token.
I'm trying to figure out whether you said it's you. Is it me, or is it me and everything I've done, so it knows that I have
the
a cart
token
and that
is
I have
you.
Something
so
in
the
it.
Token is an. It's like it's made up a name for you. If you remember back to yesterday's conversation, it's like an ID. It's just invented a random ID, and it will then stick that random ID to any information it wants to remember. So if the web server wants a shopping cart, it will use that ID to mark the shopping cart as being yours.
Okay.
Right.
So it really is me. Got you.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, it's you on that particular browser. If you use a different browser, it'll get different cookies. It'll be a different you.
Okay.
And then private browsing actually works by just throwing away all of your cookies and having an empty set of cookies. And it does a few other things, but that's one of its big things it does. So the web server will invent this random token to represent you and keep a copy on its side, and it will use that token to label everything it's keeping track of that belongs to you. And it will then take that same random token and stick it in a cookie, which it will hand to the web browser along with the page the web browser requested. So the web browser said, "Dear Amazon, give me the Amazon homepage." Amazon server will generate this unique token and then stick that cookie into the reply to you, which is the Amazon webpage. Your browser will then take that token, that cookie, and it will store it next. So it will have a little table inside its brain that says Amazon.com, this cookie. And from that point forward, until the cookie expires, every time your browser communicates with Amazon.com, it says, "I'd like this page and here's my cookie. I'd like this page and here's my cookie." So that means that both sides now have this token they're passing around. So it suddenly becomes possible to have state. So you can have a shopping cart. You can log into things. State has been added to the web. Hooray!
So that's everything's good then. This is back.
Everything's good so far.
Before there was evil in the world.
Yes, and so far, these are all what we call first-party cookies. So you and Amazon are having a conversation, and the only people involved are you and Amazon. There's no one else involved in the equation yet. Where things go weird is when you introduce a third party. So how does that happen? So when you get a web page from a server, what the server actually returns is a bunch of HTML, hypertext markup language. And that HTML will contain some text and stuff, but it can also contain references to other things that your browser should fetch to fill in the page. So the obvious ones are images, right? So if you have a web page with four pictures, you get the web page from the first request, then your browser processes the answer it got. That answer says, and you need these four images. And then each of those four images is a separate request saying, oh, give me that picture at this URL, give me that picture at this URL, and so on and so forth. And there's also things like fonts nowadays are fetched from URLs and style sheets and JavaScript code. So there's lots of things you can be told to reach out and fetch. So the initial response from the server can embed URLs. And then your browser has to go fetch those. And if everything in the page is going back to Amazon, then the whole conversation is a first-party conversation. So if you go to the Amazon homepage and it sends you some HTML back that refers to five images, and all five of those images are on Amazon.com, then you've ended up having six conversations, six connections, but they've all been to Amazon, so the whole thing is first-party, and that's the end of that. But there's no reason on this planet the URLs injected into the web pages can't be from somewhere else. So if you go to BartB.ie, one of the things you're going to see is a grid of my recent photographs. They're not coming from BartB.ie. They're coming from Flickr.com because that's where I host my photographs. So in that case, there's three parties in the conversation. You visited my website. So you're the first party. I'm the second party. And then my website has said, and fetch these images from Flickr. Now Flickr's the third party. So someone else has now joined this conversation.
But
what happens then?
You wanted to do that, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Otherwise you wouldn't be able to do that. You wouldn't be able to embed a YouTube video.
Exactly. Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. This is not a problem, but this is just a thing that happens. So there are third parties involved in a web page load, is kind of what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Now, when you go to BartB.ie and you then are told, oh, yeah, and grab these photos from Flickr, your browser then has a whole other conversation with Flickr's web servers, and it's exchanging cookies with Flickr's web servers. Now, Flickr will never see the cookie that you have with my website, and I will never see the cookie you have with Flickr. So that's good, because they're kept separate, right? A cookie belongs to a domain. No one will ever see your cookie to Amazon other than Amazon. So far, no danger. However, you will remember the cookie you were given from the third party. And every time you make a web request, you don't just hand over the cookie. There's also this HTTP header called HTTP referrer, which tells the website what URL the photograph is for. So if you go to BartB.ie and it links to 10 Flickr images, when Flickr gets the request for those 10 images, that request will contain the header that says, oh yeah, and I'm going to show these on BartB.ie.
Say that one more time. So just repeat that section. How does...
Okay. So when... Okay, so you go to BartB.ie and you get back some HTML from me. Mm-hmm. Your browser reads that, and that HTML contains image tags which say go to Flickr.com.
Right.
When your browser goes to Flickr.com because I told it to, the browser inserts into the request to Flickr.com a little header, it's called the HTTP referrer, which says, I am looking for this URL, and I'm looking for it because this website told me to.
Oh, okay, okay.
So Flickr know that BartB.ie has embedded...
Oh, so some information has been shared between these two sites.
Yes, it has.
Okay.
Still, so far, nothing. It doesn't immediately sound like panic stations yet, and it shouldn't, mm-hmm. because this is all fairly normal. So we have the HTTP embed, and you have the fact that there are cookies to both parties, but they're not the same cookie, so there's no breach of privacy there either. So far, things are looking okay. So where did these? What does this nefarious stuff come in? Well, the Flickr case, there's nothing really nefarious going on because you as the end user see the image and it's all above board. But what if there was another third party and they were sending something not visible on the page that was injected? Maybe a JavaScript that does almost nothing so that it's not visible. And what if that company paid millions of websites to stick their little secret bit of JavaScript into millions of URLs all across the internet? Then what happens? You go to BartB.ie, and let's say I have taken part in eviltracker.com, we'll call it. So you go to BartB.ie, I give you back the HTML from my page, you go off to Flickr, you do your thing, and I also now include this extra little line that says, oh, and grab this invisible 1 pixel by 1 pixel image from eviltracker.com. You go to EvilTracker.com and you get a cookie from them, which your browser will accept and store. And EvilBrowser.com knows you're on BartB.ie because of the referrer header. You then go to podfeet.com, and Allison too has gone to the dark side and is also now being paid by EvilTracker.com to serve their little 1 pixel by 1 pixel invisible image. Mm-hmm. Now they get the same cookie, which means they know that you are the same person who is on BartB.ie. And this time the header says you're on podfeet.com. And then you go to Facebook, and they also have taken part in EvilTracker.com. Same cookie from you, different referrer header.
So this Evil is getting Tracker added to this same cookie?
No, the cookie just identifies you. The cookie identifies you as you go around the entire internet. And every time that you contact Evil Tracker, the header says what URL you're coming from. So the tracker just takes a note and it builds up a database. And it basically, the more places it gets to put its little secret hidden referrer, the more times you're bitten on the backside by this third-party cookie, which is being used to track you all across the internet. And very soon they know everywhere you've been online. This is why Facebook have a like button. It makes your browser talk to Facebook wherever you are on the internet. You have a cookie from Facebook. You've been to Facebook. You're a Facebook user. And then every time you see a like button, Facebook knows you are there.
Well, let's start with something that's not considered as evil as Facebook. When you go to Amazon.
Okay, when you go to Amazon, right, the point is these third parties. You have gone to science.com or whatever, and they have included a like button, so they've added a third party into the equation.
No,
you
didn't go without a like button, my Amazon traffic follows me around the web.
It's following around the web because of DoubleClick, because there is a hidden tracker all over the web.
But how did it get the cookie from me being at Amazon? Without Amazon participating.
They absolutely participated completely, totally, 110%. You can have third party tracking.
I'm trying to take this apart from evil Facebook to a lot of fully established normal companies.
Facebook are way less evil than most.
But I'm trying to get away from that, just any hint of that. Talk about Amazon. So Amazon is participating in this problem.
Okay, Amazon pay random websites around the internet to stick a completely hidden piece of HTML into their page so that you have to talk to Amazon to view their page.
Okay.
They make Amazon into a third party. That's how they track you. Web ads are used to track you all over the internet.
Web ads. You mean like my custom ads that I do where I put a link into Amazon on my site?
If you were to just use the copy paste that Amazon give you, then you would be taking part in the tracking, but you that actually is, just have a link.
No, but that is a copy paste. I go over there and it gives me a unique URL that gives me credit if you click it.
Okay, but you don't. Amazon also offer a code tag that lets it automatically create all sorts of stuff. You don't inject that, which means that the person visiting podfeet.com is not receiving code from amazon.com. They're clicking on a link. That's not the same thing.
Okay. I'd have to see sometime where the other option is. Not that I want to go do it. I just don't understand.
You used to do it the other way, and then listeners made you change it because they told you that Ghostery was showing your site tracking people, and you changed it. You actively changed it about 3 or 4 years ago. It was a big deal. Listeners contacted you, said that your site was doing tracking. You went, oh, I don't want it to do tracking. You looked into it, and then you replaced the code Amazon.
So now I know what you're talking about. So I do what's called custom ads, which is I go and I find e-grips for the back of your iPhone. I go to Amazon, I find that, and I get a link that is specific to that product, and I put that into the HTML. What I think maybe what you're talking about is that in my sidebar, I used to just have a search thing where it was Amazon. You could go search for something. And if that, maybe that's what you're talking about.
But to put that search box in, you had a script tag, which has its URL, something that Amazon.com.
Yeah.
That made everyone who went to podfeet.com's browser go to Amazon.com, send Amazon their tracking cookie. Bang, they knew you were in Podfeet.
But the blockers today still block when I put in one of the little embedded images. That I get through same process. Those are still blocked.
Right. If you put in an image, then you're inducing everyone who visits your page to talk to Amazon. So tracking is go. Okay. If you just put a link without a picture, there will be no
tracking. Because I haven't stopped that. And if I do, that's a giant loss in income to keep the podcast afloat. So
it's also a giant loss of usefulness.
Yeah.
Like, I want to see what I'm clicking on.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's not really, we're getting derailed here a little bit.
Okay, but now I understand better. Okay.
Yes. So these third parties come in. Now, you as an end user don't see these third parties, but these third parties come in when people on the web participate and inject just a little bit of code to make your browser talk to the third party and have a little chat. So you go to science.com, but that science.com makes your browser behind your back without anything obvious to you talk to N trackers, and they can track you. And the reason this works is because there is one store of cookies in your browser, which means that when you're on podfeet.com and you're told to talk to eviltracker.com, it's the same cookie. When you're on bartb.ie, it's the same cookie that you're sending to evil.com. When you're on wherever, it's the same cookie. Okay. Actually, do you know the wonderful thing? Do you know what they call the place where your browser keeps the cookies? And I'm not making this up. This is the actual
jar?
Technical term. Yes!
Oh, that's awesome. Yes,
cookies go in the cookie jar. So there is a cookie jar. Is how the internet has worked up until now. Apple's idea was to not have one jar, to have multiple jars. It's as simple as that. So how does this work? If you, let's say you go to, okay, so I'm still evil, right? I've turned to the dark side and there's a tracker embedded into bartb.ie, right? You go to my website on Safari 11. What's different? Okay, so you come to my website. I hand you some HTML. That HTML says, go talk to eviltracker.com. Safari will go and talk to eviltracker.com. But before it sends eviltracker.com a cookie, it asks a very simple question. It looks through its browser history and it says, has the person using this browser ever had a first-party relationship with eviltracker.com? The answer is going to be no, because eviltracker.com is just a secret hidden thing. You haven't gone there intentionally, so you never had a first-party relationship. If there is no first-party relationship, it will make an entirely separate cookie jar, pretend to be a whole new person, and accept the cookie from eviltracker.com and put it in this separate jar. And this jar gets saved with bartb.ie, and that cookie will only ever be used while you're on my website. So you know the way in Safari 11 you now have per website settings?
Yeah.
Well, you have per website cookie jars.
So it's not two cookie jars. It's as many cookie jars as you need.
One for the first party ones. Yes.
And then
for every first party site you go to, there'll be a separate cookie jar.
Oh, even first parties will have separate cookie jars.
No. So the first party cookies stay in the system cookie jar, but every third party cookie will go in a separate cookie jar belonging to the first party site you happen to be on at that moment.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So Bart B is the first cookie jar in that case, but eviltracker.com is the second one. So therefore that gets its own cookie jar.
No. Okay. So bartb.ie gets its own cookie jar because that's the first party URL you went to. The third party cookies from that first party site go in that special cookie jar.
I still don't understand whether there's more than one first party cookie jar?
No. So the first party cookie jar is the system wide cookie jar.
Okay. And bartb.ie goes into that because that is a first party. I'm going actively to there.
Yes,
but the third party cookie that comes from that goes into a separate cookie jar that only gets invoked when I go to the first party website, which is bartb.ie.
Yes, which is confusing to say.
Yeah.
But the magic happens when you then go to Allison, who has also gone over to the dark side, and you go to podfeet.com, who's also using eviltracker.com. So your first party relationship is with podfeet.com. You're then told to go to a third party who you don't have a relationship with.
Mm-hmm.
It makes another cookie jar and tells eviltracker.com that you're a whole new person. And
but doesn't that mean eviltracker.com isn't going to know where I've be able to talk to each other and know where I've been across the internet?
Exactly. It will only be able to track you within one site. It will see what you're doing on podfeet.com and it will see what you're doing on bartb.ie, but it will have no idea the two of you are the same. However, if you there are legitimate reasons for third-party cookies. They make all sorts of shared services on the internet work. So as soon as you have a first-party relationship with a site, you go into the system-wide cookie jar and everything continues to work.
Cool. That's
so you get to have your cake and eat it. By
you
having
get to have your cookie and eat it?
That's a much better, yes, okay, yes, thank you. So it is wonderfully clever. And such a great idea. And as a side effect, so because they had to invent these per website cookie jars, they've also started doing per website preferences for things like font size and stuff, like you were telling me how great it was, because they needed to have this whole per website setting thing anyway for the cookie. So why not allow it to do other stuff too?
Yeah, certain websites, bartb.ie, have really, really, really small fonts. And so terrible, I always go there, go command plus, 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 plus every time. And now I don't have to.
Yep.
Oh, so basically the same technology. If you right click on the URL, that's where you get the option to do that. I think it's also in a preference somewhere. But if you just right click on the URL, you can say what you want that site to do.
Yep. So since they had the technology for per site cookie jars, they just said, oh, sure, while we're at it, we'll also keep per site settings because it's the same brains.
Yeah.
So it's brilliant.
That's absolutely fabulous. Brilliant. By the way, the other favorite thing in there is you can set certain sites to always be reader view. So if you've got a website that's just covered with junk, you don't have to look at the junk. You can, every time you go there, it'll be in reader view.
Yeah. So it's as I say, it's absolutely brilliant. Now, there is one small caveat. Mm. So if we bring Facebook back into this conversation, if you're someone like me who doesn't use Facebook, I do not have a first-party relationship with Facebook, which means that all the Facebook cookies I see from like buttons are separated from each other into those little islands of third-party cookie jars. So I can't be tracked by Facebook anymore. But if you're an actual Facebook user, you have a first-party relationship with Facebook, which means that your Facebook cookies are going into the central cookie jar and you are being tracked across the web by like buttons. But you've chosen to be a Facebook user.
I'm confused. So I go to, Bart doesn't like Facebook, but he's got a Facebook like button. I go there and I don't even click that button. And you're saying I've got tracking on?
No, what I'm saying, okay, so if there's a like button and you have a first party relationship with Facebook, then yes, there's tracking going on.
And I don't click it.
No, just right. Physically drawing that picture involved your browser asking the Facebook server to send you the ones and zeros for that picture. That involves you exchanging cookies. That's it. You're tracked. That's the evil genius of the like button.
Is it just the like button? Because there's Google Plus buttons. There's...
Oh, all of them. All of them. That's why so many websites have these, like this
Tumblr and
this blurt of icons. It's because they all want to track people, so they're all incentivizing websites to put those buttons up, those share buttons. They are purely there to track you.
And I had those up for a while, and then I thought, you know what, those are ugly and stupid, and I took them down.
Yep.
So let me this is still bothering me. I'm still not quite following it. So okay. Bartb.ie, I'm going to go there actively, and that's my, I've got a first-party relationship, yes, with Bartb.ie. And Bart, because he's just a horrible human being, has this Facebook like button.
Sure.
And
let's pretend I've turned a leaf completely. Yes, I have a Facebook like button.
Yes, you are, but you don't go to Facebook. So I go over to Facebook, but is there let me finish my question. If I'm on your website and you have that Facebook like button, does that somehow cause me to have a first party relationship with eviltracker.com? Or is it just just that I'm tracked, that Facebook knows I went to bartb.ie?
Yes, exactly. So
okay.
So if you have a first party relationship with Facebook in your history, then you don't go into the secret cookie jar, you go into the central cookie jar, because that is a website you actively use. Eviltracker.com is not a website you're ever going to actively visit, so you're never going to have had a first-party relationship, so that's why that cookie goes into the separate little cookie jar. So basically, websites who are trying to inject cookies that you don't actually use actively, that you don't use intentionally, they go into the separate cookie jars, whereas websites you actively type into the URL bar or click on links from your email to, you have first-party relationships with those, so those don't go into the separate cookie jar. So any website you actively visit can track you, and websites that you've never heard of that you don't actively visit can't. So you're choosing, by choosing to be a Facebook user, you have a relationship with them. By choosing to be a Google Plus user, you have a relationship with Google. So I am being tracked all across the web by Google because I have a relationship with Google.
So that doesn't say that if Google has a relationship with eviltracker.com, it's going to cause anything. It's just that first party relationship connection.
Yeah, if I haven't typed eviltracker.com into my address bar and hit enter, then I do not have a first party relationship with eviltracker.com.
Okay.
If I have ever been to google.com, I do have a first party relationship with google.com in Safari's mind. I have been a user there. And the exact details of how many days back in time, I don't remember those off the top of my head, but basically, if you've actively visited Facebook in the last N number of days, then Facebook doesn't go into the super secret cookie jar. It goes into the real cookie jar. If you have not been to Facebook in N days, then it is treated as someone you don't have a relationship with, and it does go into the super secret cookie jars.
Okay. I think I follow it. So
it's about what you choose to do, and it's a very clever way of dealing with it. I'm really impressed with what Apple have done.
Yeah. So how are the other parties reacting, the ad people?
They basically, the ad people are acting particularly badly because Facebook actually are not all that pushed about this, because Facebook have users. Facebook have a billion users and counting. So this doesn't really affect Facebook, because Facebook offer you something in exchange for your privacy. That's the deal. And it's a real deal you've entered into. The ad people, on the other hand, they have no relationship with you. You do not actively go seeking ad servers. Why would you? You don't want them. So they have no relationship with you, but they want to track you. And they're being stopped by this, because none of us have first party relationships with ad websites. Why would we?
Yeah. So, okay, here's another subtlety. I have a first party relationship with Amazon, and I have a first party relationship with Facebook. So this means that I will still get ads for things I've already bought over on Facebook.
Yes.
Okay. Good.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they're places you use, right?
If you ever want to know what you bought, like you're trying to remember the name of a product, just go to one of those sites and you'll see what you bought, because they'll be going,
I do not understand why such a clever industry is so dumb as to advertise the things it knows I've bought.
You know why?
What, do you think I want two of them?
No, I think I know why, and I have come to peace with it. It means it doesn't know that I've bought it, which is a good thing. If it knew that I bought it, I doubt it would show it to me. It would show me something.
Yes.
The ones that are just like this is if you go to the grocery store and you buy Charmin and you buy it with your little card, which is, of course, tracking you, your discount card that's tracking you, you will definitely be given an ad for a discount coupon on something just like it that's not what you wanted. If you ask for Charmin, it'll give you whatever fluffy soft, I don't know the name of another toilet paper company, but it'll give you an ad for that. It's like, I just chose this, so you're going to tell me, hey, buy this other one instead.
Okay. Yeah. So someone in work was saying, oh, it's terrible. I mean, I get all these coupons from the supermarket and they're never for the brands I want. And it's like, yeah, that's the point. That is literally the point.
Yep.
The competitor has paid to have the users of their competitors targeted for that particular advertisement.
That is
the feature.
Go buy the smallest possible quantity of some terrible toilet paper and you get a coupon for the Charmin that you wanted in the first place.
Oh, that's evil genius. That is evil genius. I like it. And then you stock up a year's supply on the cheap price and you do it again.
There
genius.
You go.
Absolutely
there you go.
Genius.
Well, I really appreciate the long form of this explanation, because I absolutely did not understand that. And this is really cool. Very interesting.
Excellent. I do also then need to throw in one small little thing. This is not related to the cookie stuff at all, but it's been conflated by some people in the Twitterverse and in the less tech savvy parts of the tech media, which shouldn't exist, but so do exist. So this cookie feature is a whole different thing, and completely separate to that, Apple have also introduced, there's a slight relationship, but it doesn't matter. There is, if you choose to opt into it, Safari has the option for your browser to report to Apple servers any problem websites you browse to, and it uses differential privacy to anonymize that data. So what Apple are trying to do is get some sort of idea about which websites are causing problems on the internet. And so they're not tracking your web browsing. They're tracking the performance of websites, which is literally the other way around. But this is being reported in the media as Apple tracking users despite blocking advertisers, which is absolute factual horse poop. It's just not correct. So I just want to say that if you've been reading those the headlines, that's wrong. It's just factually nonsense.
Yeah, I just noticed something. I don't know whether this is because of the way I had it set before and it got carried over to Safari 11, but open save files after downloading is unchecked. I wonder if they changed the default on that.
Either they changed the default, which would be superb, or they stopped resetting the defaults after you upgrade, which would be good.
Yeah, I'd like it to be the first one, though. That'd be neato.
I would love it to be the first one, but the fact that it's at least the second one is progress.
Yeah, yeah. Now I'm going
to... That used to keep getting magically turned on.
Right. I hated that.
Okay, let's jump into the rest of the news. That was a that wasn't a medium. That was, I don't know what that was. That was, I think it was useful, but it was certainly not
that
short.
That was a tutorial.
Yes, it was. So notable security updates. So Apple have released a whole bunch of OSs. Do bear in mind they all contain security updates. This is particularly true of the iOSs. So you really shouldn't be dawdling on the iOS updates because Apple don't keep the other ones patched. So the security fixes in iOS 11 that are not in iOS 10 and are never going to be in iOS 10. So you are less secure until you update.
Yeah, they don't retroactively upgrade previous iOSs, do they?
No, they assume the idea with iOS is that you move forward. This Luddite attitude of updating at your leisure is gone. You get over it. The world has moved on. I know some people's heads are exploding. Lots of people are now screaming at me. I don't care.
It's been out for long enough that I think if it were a catastrophe, we'd have known by now.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying don't wait 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours, whatever, but don't wait a month.
Yeah. Is a week okay?
I'm not going to argue how many angels can dance on the head of a pin, but you're taking a risk. Be aware of the fact that you're taking a risk and decide how you want to deal with that fact. That to be honest, yeah, my answer isn't don't do it. My answer is don't do it unknowingly.
Okay.
So be conscious. I also want to draw people's attention to a very odd bug in a nerdy app that some of our listeners may like to use called iTerm2, which is a fancy pants terminal app for the Mac. So it's basically a third party alternative to Apple's terminal that app. Some people adore it. I've never seen the point, but hey, you know, to each their own. I know very, very passionate iTerm2 users. They had a bit of a bug which, in order to try highlight links and make them clickable in your terminal, because of course you'd want to do that, their code for figuring out what may or may not be a website was a little bit too accepting, resulting in it making DNS queries, which could, if you watch the DNS queries, reveal sensitive information. So it was basically doing a DNS query for your password as if it was a domain name. So if you were watching the unencrypted DNS queries, and DNS queries are by their nature unencrypted, then you would see flying by on port 53 UDP your password. Wrapped in a DNS query, but nonetheless your password or whatever sensitive information happened to be showing up in iTerm. So that was a silly bug. They've fixed it. They've basically changed probably their regular expressions, now that I think about it. But they've changed their code to not go looking up stuff on DNS so frivolously. So as I say, it's not set your hair on fire, but if I was an iTerm2 user, I would simply allow it to update itself and carry on with my life.
All right.
Notable news. A Washington Court of Appeals has ruled that so-called Stingray devices, so these are fake cell towers that police were using to intercept cell phone conversations. Of course, these are not targeted devices, right? These things just hoover everyone up in the area. Using those without a warrant from a court has been ruled to be incompatible with the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, i.e. protection from unreasonable search and seizure.
Oh, nice.
So they're not saying you can't use stingrays. They're saying you can't use stingrays without the proper oversight of the court system.
Didn't they do that on a building full of people once to say, well, we think, you know, Bob on the third floor was kind of looking sideways at us, so we want to scan this whole building?
Oh, there's been all sorts of horror stories about this stuff being done just on a whim. Yeah, I've lost track of how terrible stories there are about stingrays being abused.
I'm so quite fond of good. The Washington Court of Appeals.
Yeah, that's, yeah. Actually, you're right. I have heard them mentioned a few times in wise judgments. So well done, Washington Court of Appeals. UK courts, on the other hand, have done something a bit more controversial. They have convicted a campaigner who is apparently a controversial figure in his own right, but that I don't think that makes a difference to the story, really. Basically, this chap was crossing into the UK and police at the border said, hand over your encryption keys. And he said, no, my computer contains sensitive information that could compromise people. And they went, sorry, don't give a bleep. We want that information and we're prosecuting you. And the court went, yep, you're guilty. So under
guilty
UK law
of
obstructing justice. And the UK does not have the US Constitution, so the UK does not have a Fourth Amendment.
Huh.
Well, it has a Fourth Amendment. No, actually, the UK has an unwritten constitution. The UK Constitution, believe it or not, is unwritten. It's kind of whatever we say it is. Yeah.
Oh, yikes.
That's an interesting legal system they have.
That's also unusual. So, usually, Europe's privacy laws are more protecting of humans than the US.
Yes. However, the UK has always been the odd man out in Europe.
Okay.
They didn't Brexit in a vacuum. They have never been a normal European country. Never been fully on board, ever.
Okay.
So yeah, they're different in many ways. I mean, where in the world are you the most surveilled?
Oh yeah, they got a lot of cameras there from what I understand.
A lot of cameras. And their Investigatory Powers Act, which comes into this court case actually, is extremely Chinese looking in its powers. Like the UK has previous on this. They're not like France or Germany. They're very different culturally. Anyway, a very important message to anyone who has an iCloud account, which I think is a lot of people listening to this show. Okay. There have been news reports doing the rounds. So this is real. There are actual human beings being targeted like this. The symptoms are, all of a sudden, your Mac is in lost mode with a message saying, give me so many Bitcoin or you're never getting your Mac back.
Wait.
Basically, these people have had their iCloud password stolen, and the person who stole the password has used that password to mark the device as stolen.
Oh.
It would appear.
So it does lock your Mac?
It does. Just, so if you lose your phone and you use Find My iPhone to lock it, it will lock. Well, if you, in inverted commas, i.e. not really you, but someone who stole your password, uses Find My Mac, they can lock your Mac.
Yikes.
And then obviously you need to have the password to get it back, but you don't have your password anymore because you've lost control of your account because you lost control of your password. So this appears to be happening because of password reuse. So we have so many data breaches that there are so many username and password combos flying around the place that attackers appear to be simply trying them against iCloud accounts. Like,
wow.
Well, this person is, you know, jblogs@yahoo.com. We have their Yahoo password. I wonder if jblogs@icloud.com uses the same password.
Wow. I hate my password. So I'm probably not going to get hacked because it's horrible. The worst part about my iCloud account was I had some problem. I can't remember what it was, but I remember there was a third party email client that when Apple changed the behavior of the way they talk to servers or something, it caused them to ping excessively. So I got locked out of my iCloud account and I had to change my password, and I had to change it 3 times in like 3 days. And so, of course, what I did, I had a really good password, but I just started like changing capitalization. So every time I do it, I have to go, okay, which one of those words did I leave?
Was it again?
And when Steve has to use it, he's like, why do you have such a stupid password? This thing's ridiculous. Why does it do it? I said, well, it's not my fault. I'm not changing it now because I actually know it. But yeah, I will not be hacked because mine is so annoying. That's a good sign. If you hate typing your password, you're probably doing it right.
Yes. Now, the key point here is, A, it should be a strong password. But in this case, they're not brute forcing of things. It doesn't appear that these are brute force attacks. It appears this is password reuse. So while a strong password is important, a unique password is probably even more important.
Oh, good point. Good point. Yeah.
So that is the take-home message.
Because they've hacked one and then they use it to get into the other.
It's not just, they didn't even have to hack anything. Like, there are so many password breaches.
Yeah.
There are just so many username and password combos out there on the net, on Pastebin and all over the place. that if your password isn't unique, the chances are it's somewhere out there. And it's just a matter of some 12-year-old kid somewhere just like changing Yahoo to iCloud and trying. I mean,
so
really, this isn't hard.
A bad password in iCloud would be better than a good password that you've used on Yahoo. Everywhere else or Yahoo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that is kind of perverse, but yes.
Yeah. I'm going to add that to my list of things to tell people. Yeah.
And we really are in a situation now where you have to assume that a reused password is known by everyone, because if you've used it on more than one site, the probability is stupendously high that it's known.
Yeah. Now, so you may be able to get your account back if you know all of the answers to the security questions and such, and they're not security questions that you answered with the right answer and available already in another hack.
Yeah, the thing is, though, when you lock a machine, you get given a PIN that's used to unlock the machine. Because it may be your only Apple device. You may never be able to prove yourself to Apple again. So the PIN is what you need to take something out of lost.
But if you call Apple and tell them that my account was stolen, I will prove to you that I am who I say I am. You're saying they wouldn't let you back in?
They may not have it in their power. If that PIN is truly cryptographically secure and the PIN is never communicated back to Apple servers, Apple may not have the PIN to give you.
Maybe.
I don't know. Yeah. I don't know the answer. So I'm guessing.
So keep this from happening in the first place is a better idea.
The other really important takeaway, because ultimately this is no different. You can just have bad luck of all kinds. Your hard drive could explode. Mm-hmm. So you should have a backup, because worst case scenario here, just nuke and pave, start over again.
Oh, yeah. Good point.
So you basically have a backup and have a unique password in your iCloud account. They're your takeaways.
Yeah.
Just in case people are Instagram users, you now have the ability to block people from commenting on your posts. Kind of hard to believe you didn't have that ability before, but apparently you didn't, so yay. Apple have also re-upped their privacy page to give basically more clearer information, if you'll excuse my terrible grammar. So basically, go have a peruse and see how you feel. Apple are good about this kind of stuff, so there's nothing earth-shattering here. Apple have also made a change to iOS 11 that boosts your privacy, apart from the Safari thing we've already talked about in such detail. This is one of those from the department of this is why we can't have nice things. So this has broken a few legitimate apps, unfortunately. In the past, i.e. up to and including iOS 10, there was an API call that you could, as an app developer, use to tell you the MAC address of the Wi-Fi card on your device. Which can be useful for network debugging tools. They're only going to be for highly nerd tools. It's not going to be useful to your average game or whatever. Unfortunately, some unscrupulous people started to use that as a way to track users across iOS installs and basically across apps and across all the different things that you're not supposed to have to track people across on iOS. So basically, your iPhone has the same MAC address and always will have the same MAC address. Therefore, if I make 10 apps, I can link different profiles across all the different apps I make by simply checking if they're coming from the same MAC address. If someone does a complete nuke and pave of iOS, I can reconnect all the data I connected because it has the same MAC address. And so Apple have went, fine, if you're going to abuse this API, we're taking it away. It's gone in iOS 11. No more access to the MAC address.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
It's good, but I'm sad.
Because?
I'm sad because it's needed. I'm sad they had to do this. I'm delighted they did it. I wish I lived in a planet where they didn't have to.
Yeah.
If you are an Android user and you use a pattern unlock, please stop. The U.S. Naval Academy and the University of Maryland, Baltimore County have done the research. They have the numbers to back it up. It's not secure. Stop it.
So this is where you just like scribble on screen?
Yep. Human beings are terrible at being random. The scribbles are just do not provide sufficient security.
From what I understand, you can see the slime on somebody's screen for the pattern they did.
That too. Yeah. Even if you leave that aside, you know the way the reason XKPassWD is important is because humans are terrible at being random?
Right.
Well, we're terrible at picking random numbers. We're even worse at picking random shapes.
Well... yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? You know, a figure eight with a heart drawn over the top of it and an arrow down to the bottom right? You're not going to do all that, right?
Exactly. Well, there is that. So there's a limited possibilities. But even in the limited set of things you could do, we human beings are really strongly biased towards a very small subset of the small set of possibilities. So it's even worse than you think, basically, is what it comes down to. Some bad news. So there's a company, a security researcher called IOActive, and they have this thing, which they do, and I love them for it, where they investigate the back ends of apps. So many, many apps we use interact with some sort of cloud service. So the app is on our phone, but the app isn't useful on its own. It's asking the internet, what is the current exchange rate? What's the current value of stocks? What's the current balance on my bank account? You know, there's an interaction between the app and the servers belonging to someone or something. And in theory, all of that communication should be over HTTPS. And in theory, the app should throw an error if that HTTPS connection is interrupted with an invalid login or something. So in theory, eavesdropping shouldn't be possible. In practice, an awful lot of apps are built by very shoddy people, and these apps technically use the HTTPS APIs, but they don't actually set any of the flags to say if the certificate doesn't match AUGA, AUGA. They just sort of trust anything they're given, so they may as well not bother, because you can completely man in the middle of them because they'll accept any certificate. And you would think that financial apps would not be so dumb. So IOActive went, fine, let's not assume, let's test. Let us attempt man-in-the-middle attacks against these apps and see how many apps let us attack them. They did it last year, or a few years ago, against banking apps and were horrified. Well, now they've done it against stock trading apps. And I'm afraid to say they're even worse than the banking apps. And this is not an iOS thing or an Android thing. This is a mobile apps thing. Doesn't matter what platform you're on, people writing apps are terrible at doing security basics. So details linked in the show notes. So maybe check that your app that you use to trade your stocks and shares isn't on the list. And if it is on the list, change.
Yeah.
Or use the web directly. Go to, you know, you can use Safari on the iPhone and actually surf to the website and do your stock trades. That's fine. Just don't use an app that doesn't properly secure your transactions. That's not good. I also noticed a trend in my RSS feeds. People seem to be maliciously using JavaScript to steal your CPU cycles to make bitcoins. So you go to a web page and it sends you some JavaScript that makes your computer use its RAM and CPU to do number crunching for Bitcoin mining and then send the answers back to whoever made the JavaScript. So they're basically stealing your CPU.
We should do that. We know JavaScript now. Can you teach us to do that?
I can. I will not. So,
come on.
The Pirate
Become
Bay
rich
were caught
and famous with programming by stealth. Oh, rich and infamous.
Infamous, exactly. So the Pirate Bay were caught doing this, which is not entirely shocking, but Showtime were also caught doing this, which I'm assuming means that they were probably hacked and someone injected this maliciously. They very, very quickly stopped. So the past tense in the headline for the Showtime headline is intentional.
Okay,
they
so
were doing it,
they
have stopped.
You just mean, you don't mean Pirate Bay stopped.
No, I don't mean Pirate Bay stopped.
Okay.
I mean, Showtime websites secretly mined in the past tense, user CPUs for cryptocurrency. So the Verge were not mistaken in the past tense. They were reporting on something which had been discovered. And as soon as they reported at the Showtime, they went, gone. lots of suggested reading. I don't want to dwell on this too long because we've been here a while. iOS 11 and macOS High Sierra have come out. And although they each contain their own user-facing features that you're going to hear talked about a million and one times, like the no autoplay of video and all these kind of things, but they also contain tweaks and improvements to the privacy and security of both OSs. Now, they're not earth-shattering because Apple are starting at a high baseline, but they're continued incremental betterments. So the guys over at Intego have written two extremely well put together blog posts that go through this. So they have iOS 11, a complete guide to iOS security and privacy. And of the two articles, this one is actually like, this is like 5.5 stars.
Really?
Because not only are they telling you what's new, they've actually written it in such a way that they're just telling you all of the important security features and they're just highlighting what's new.
Oh,
so
cool.
It's actually a full a full primer on getting your device configured in a way that matches your desires in terms of security and privacy. So they tell you what controls there are, and they tell you how you can lock it down and why you might not want to. Basically, they allow you to make an informed decision about all the important decisions. So in other words, they tell you, these are the decisions a security-aware person should make. Here's the trade-offs. Do as you wish, which is entirely reasonable. They shouldn't be saying, do this, do this, do this. They should tell you, here are the settings, here are the implications, decide. And that's what they do. So they're going through the full set of features and just tagging, oh, and by the way, this is new. Their Mac High Sierra article is good, but it's only telling you what's new, which is not as cool.
It's only 5 stars, not 5.5.
Exactly. I mean, they're both well-written articles. They're both, they're not long either, which is nice. The iOS 7 one is, I guess, is fairly long, but it's not tedious. Just a reminder to people that Apple's two-step verification is going away, being replaced by the newer two-factor authentication. Macworld had a nice little write-up on that that I thought was worth linking to.
And I don't find that to be a pain.
No, you I don't.
I whined a lot at the beginning when I switched over because it was so hard, but it's not bothering me.
Apple's second attempt at two-factor authentication is much better than Apple's first attempt, which is, oh, good, right? That's how it should be. You should learn from your mistakes rather than repeating them. So I guess that's we'll see that as a good thing. The notable breaches, there's one I have a star next to because I don't know how big of a deal it is. There is an American drive-through takeout place called Sonic. They have had a credit card breach, which appears to have lost millions of credit cards. But I have no idea if there's like 5 of those in one state or if that's like a national thing. So if you're an American, Sonic, I don't know if it rings a bell to you, but if it does, they've just lost millions of credit cards.
Credit and debit cards. Yikes.
Yes. Yes. So whatever you're using to buy your takeout. Yeah.
Hmm. Do we know if it was unencrypted or any of that kind of stuff?
Well, if they lost the credit cards, then it's a credit card breach. So, yes, they were unencrypted.
Right. Well, because so that doesn't necessarily mean they're out in the clear, is my question.
Okay. From my understanding of how Brian Krebs reports on these things, yes, it does, because his source is bank fraud. So, basically, banks are seeing fraudulent transactions, and those fraudulent transactions correlate with cards that were used in Sonic.
Yikes.
Yeah, so that's how a lot of these breaches are discovered. Basically, the banks do massive data mining on all the fraudulent transactions because with a credit card, it's the bank's money being stolen, not yours. So they are very well incentivized to research.
Yeah,
and they are constantly looking for patterns. And basically, we discover these breaches because the banks discover, oh, look, all of these stolen credit cards, what do they all have in common? Oh, they were all used within the last N months in this particular corporation. They probably have a credit card breach, and that's how it's discovered very often. I want to laugh about this because it's hilarious. Don't light your hair on fire. This is just Schadenfreude. So Adobe have a team which are called, and I'm quoting here, the Product Security Incident Response Team. They are the team that you're supposed to report Adobe security problems to. In order to allow you to securely report security problems, they have a GPG key pair, public and private keys. With what they wanted to do was put their public key out there so that security researchers could sign stuff with their public key, which means that the only person on the planet who could unencrypt it would be Adobe with the matching private key. They accidentally published both.
Oh,
jeez. The security team published their private key. Now
you're only laughing because it's Adobe, right?
I'm laughing because it's the Adobe security team. It would have been the Adobe PR and marketing team. I would have been like, look, that, oh dear, the poor people, you know.
Aren't they adorable?
Yeah, but their security team is just too funny not to mention it. This is not a disaster because they knew they did it. They went, oh dearie me, and they simply changed their key. They just generated a new key pair, and this time they kept the private key private. So there's no danger here. This is not any sort of catastrophe. It's just, I'm sorry, but I can't resist. I just have to point and laugh. I'm sorry.
Proving that Bart isn't always a good person.
No, it's, yes, that's me being evil now with my little bit of Schadenfreude. Opinion and analysis. This week, there's only 3 stories in the section. To be honest, all 3 are a good read, but I do want to expressly draw attention to two of them. Human failings undermine security, but who's failing who is the title of the article on naked security. And the, if you'll excuse the expression, money quote, the reason people continue to be the weakest link in security is that most organizations continue to fail to invest in them. Basically, over and over and over again, in many of these breaches, what has gone wrong is the squishy organic bit. And everyone is saying it's terrible, these poor users. But actually, if organizations don't invest in training the users, how is that the user's fault that they're ignorant? Right? As an organization, you have to invest in your human resources. You train them to use Office. You train them to use the photocopier. You train them for everything else. You train them on manual handling so they don't break their back.
I would agree with this and also disagree with this. Agreed that we don't spend the time and energy and investment in educating people within organizations about not being stupid, but people are still stupid. People who know better are still stupid.
Okay. But you're never going to get to perfect, right? But don't let perfect be the enemy of the good. We are doing so little that while we can never stop all problems, we can certainly stop a lot more problems than we're stopping now with a reasonable, not insane investment.
But the bag of mostly water will still be the weakest link. And it says the reason people continue to be the weakest link is, and I contend that people will still continue to be the weakest link. And I'm going to tell the story again about how I went to a conference and I met the woman who invented YubiKey, and she gave me one, and I brought it back to work and I handed it to a trusted sysadmin, one of my top-notch guys, a guy who'd been to Black Hat, had gone to the Black Hat training, had won the contest on how to hack things. I mean, this guy knew what he was talking about. I handed it to him and he stuck it in his computer. And then we both went, oh my God, I just got something that looks like a thumb drive from someone I don't know at a conference. And by the way, she just happens to be Russian, and you stuck it in your computer. We both looked at each other and said, okay, we're all screwed, right? I mean, if we knew exactly what not to do, we were highly educated on it, and we were still the weakest link. So forever, we will be the weakest link.
Okay, there is more to the article than just that one line I quoted. So the argument being made in the article, and I think made well, is that while you're never going to solve all problems, like it's not a case that if we just trained everyone, the entire security problem will be solved. Like, no, you're right. Humans are always going to be a problem. But right now we're doing so little that if we spent just a little bit more, we would make such a dent in the problem. It's the low hanging fruit. We've done the expensive stuff like bulking up our firewalls and stuff. Why don't we put a little bit of investment into the stuff we've just completely neglected? And that's just good financial sense.
We should add this to our list of things to sit around and argue about on a podcast at some point, because I disagree. I think you have to build systems that they can't be the weakest link, because they will be.
I think it takes both, right? You can't have it in such a way that it's impossible to put your back out, but you do send people in manual handling courses. Like, it is a requirement by law in Ireland that if you employ someone in an office, they go to manual handling training so they know how to lift a box.
But that doesn't stop them from lifting it incorrectly, does it?
No, but it does mean that there's a lot less problem with it, because at least people know what they should be doing. It's not the panacea. It doesn't mean that there is never a problem, but it still makes things better than if you just did nothing. And right now we're doing nothing on the security front. So there's low-hanging fruit there. We should harvest that fruit, knowing full well it's not going to solve everything, but it's still worth doing. It's like a seatbelt won't always save your life, but it's still worth wearing. And if you can do it for cheap.
Well, that's probably a great example. You can't make people wear seatbelts either.
No, that's true. You can train people all you want and they'll choose to ignore your training. But for every person who ignores your training, there was going to be someone in that room who was delighted you took the time to educate them, and who will leave that room going, excellent, thank you so much for telling me that, I now know more.
Maybe.
Not perfect, but it's still worthwhile. Would be my argument. The next time someone says to you, don't worry about the fact that we're collecting your location data, we've anonymized it. This next article explains why that is always horse poop. It boils down to the fact that the number of people who live where you live and work where you work is exactly one. Your location is... The number of people who live where you live and work where you work is exactly one.
No, it isn't.
In you and Steve's case, that is an exception. You work together as a couple. But you get what I'm saying. Within the rounding error of the size of the population, it takes very, very few data points to de-anonymize anonymized location data, is the point of the article.
So even in the methods that Apple is using, it's horse poop?
Well, no, because they're not it's location data where you say this is what a person has done, but we've completely anonymized the person. So if you can connect, what Apple is doing is it's breaking apart the fact that this same person did these 10 things. They're just collecting the fact that 10 things happened. Whereas if you have the kind of anonymized data where it says that anonymous user number one visited Starbucks and then went to the library and then did something, you still have a trail, but you've anonymized the trail. So if you keep them connected with location data, you can't anonymize them. If you disconnect them, if you say 5,000 people went to Starbucks and you don't connect that fact with the fact that 1,000 people went to the library, then there's no trail there. But as soon as you link locations together, anonymization is nonsense.
Hmm.
You see the difference?
Not really.
A collection of numbers of people in a place is different to a collection of here's what an anonymous person one did. Sequence, 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 sequence. A sequence of locations is different to a collection of numbers.
Okay.
So if there's a sequence, because of how we human beings exist on this planet, that is impossible to anonymize because you just need very, very few data points for a sequence to be immediately down to a single person.
Okay.
So sequences of locations can't be anonymized.
Okay.
But Apple aren't tracking sequences of places, to the best of my knowledge.
So if location is involved, then this is horse poop. If location is not involved, then it isn't. It can be not horse poop.
Absolutely. Basically, the point of the article is that location data is really, really... A string of locations is almost impossible to anonymize. In fact, the article makes the point that it is impossible to anonymize a string of locations. So the history of where someone has been can't be anonymous.
What about a history of IP addresses I've had?
See, that's much more random because your IP addresses are within a whole ISP. So it doesn't break down to a single human being nearly as quickly. Basically, location data
breaks down to one
possible person more quickly than other data. It's not saying that you can never de-anonymize other data. It's saying that location data is
too easy.
More, yes. It's
okay.
The usual rules don't apply. It is really, really susceptible to being de-anonymized. It's not like other data. It's worse or better or more sensitive. Do you get what I'm saying? It's different.
Yeah. Okay.
And the article explains why it's different and why you need to bear that in mind when looking at these things. And it explains it very well. And then the only last thing that I have here with a star next to it is just, this is one to put a pin in to some extent. So the Signal app, which is known for its focus on privacy and security, they have announced that they are going to be releasing a feature in the future, which is why this is not up in news. If they do this, if this becomes real, it will be a news item and we'll talk about it in more detail. But they are planning to use the DRM chips built into some Intel chipsets to protect your contacts within the app from being extracted by law enforcement or anyone else trying to steal your contact information. So they're basically using DRM for privacy, which is just so many shades of turning stuff on its head. It's brilliant. if they do this for real, I promise we'll talk about it in detail and explain how it works. But right now they've announced the plans and already there is some upset from government circles. So we shall see how that one pans out. I just love the perverseness of using DRM for the good of us instead of the good of corporations.
That's beautiful. Absolutely brilliant.
Palate cleansing. I think we've earned some. What do you think?
Yeah, I think we have.
So both of my palate cleansers are from APOD, the astronomy picture of the day from NASA, but they're really different to each other. So I think we mentioned a while ago that Cassini was going to be plunging to its death inside Saturn on one sort of final kamikaze science mission. And it did good science. But before they did that, they let it take one of those pictures, which is, I'm sure it's scientifically important too, but it is also artistically stunning. A bit like, it's not quite up to Pagan's Pale Blue Dot, but this is as much art as it is science. So it's a picture of a backlit Saturn.
Oh, nice.
Isn't it amazing?
Clicking it now. Oh, wow.
I mean, yes, it's science, but it's so much more than science. So I just saw that come up on iPod. It's like,
so that's
actually
a real photo.
That is a real photo. That is an actual photo taken by the Cassini probe on its way in to go commit suicide in Saturn's atmosphere.
Wow. That's fantastic.
Isn't it amazing?
I'm looking for, actually, I just pinged Steve to see if he's got it handy. I'll put it in the show notes if he can find it again. But there's a thing from Cassini, supposedly, that's hilarious. It's Cassini realizing that it's got to go to die.
Yes, I've seen that. If you can find that and stick in the show notes, that's good fun.
Yeah, it's hilarious. It's like, wait, guys, wait, no, you said we were coming back. It's really funny.
And the other one is also published on APOD, but it's kind of a fun flowchart. How to identify that light in the sky?
It looks like something XKCD would have done.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But it's not XKCD, it's by someone else. But I thought it was fun. So
it's just things like, is it really big? Is it moving? Are your retinas burning? That's the sun or the moon.
Thing is, it is correct. Right? I mean, it's using informal language, but it is actually correct.
That's hilarious. That's fantastic. They're perfect palate cleansers. I love it.
Excellent. Okay, well, that's all she wrote.
All right.
She says, having taken up probably the entire length of your show.
This is awesome. I'm not going to have to write anything this week. No, people love this, so this is fantastic. And that was almost like a chit-chat across the pond about the tracking thing. I really appreciated the time you put into figuring all that out and explaining it to us.
Yeah, no, it was fun. And once I got started writing, and I was like, yeah, no, we got to go with this. This is fun.
Definitely.
This is basically, let me teach something and I'll go.
All right, Bart. Well, we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks then.
Talk to you soon. Until then, stay patched and stay secure.
Well, I think that might have been a world record for security bits, but we are going to wind it up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeed.com. And you can follow me on Twitter at podfeed. Remember, everything good starts with podfeed.com. You can go to podfeed.com/Patreon to help support the show. How about podfeed.com/Facebook or podfeed.com/Google+ to get into a community to talk to other fellow Nocilla castaways. And of course, the Amazon affiliate links are at podfeed.com/Amazon. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, like Rob from Oslo, Norway did for the first time, or Ryan, who did for the first time last week, but we only this week tricked him into telling us his name, you can join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways, but I'll tell you why you should do that. You should do it because I actually said during the show earlier that heart disease was the leading cause of women. And luckily, I believe it was John from... also known as NASAnut, who said that it was probably the leading cause of death in women. Anyway, if you want to join in the fun of the live show, head on over to podfeed.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nocilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.